Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, short-barreled shotguns and violent felonies edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 20th, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Johnson versus the United States. This case concerns two questions. The first is whether mere possession of a short-barreled shotgun should be treated as a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act. The second question asks whether the residual clause in the Armed Career Criminal Act, which mandates that a minimum sentence of 15 years be imposed upon someone who unlawfully possesses a firearm and has had three prior violent felony convictions, with the phrase violent felony, including any crime that involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, is unconstitutionally vague. To discuss the case, we have Richard Myers, who is the Henry Brandis Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Myers.
Is mere possession of a short-barreled shotgun a violent felony for purposes of the Armed Career Criminal Act? And is the so-called residual clause of the Armed Career Criminal Act, which defines a violent crime as any felony that, quote, otherwise involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, end quote, unconstitutionally vague? Those were the questions before the Supreme Court on April 20th, when the justices heard arguments in Johnson versus United States. The defendant in the case, Samuel James Johnson, was convicted of weapons charges arising out of an FBI investigation into his involvement with an organization called the Aryan Liberation Movement. Among other things, the government's brief alleged that he had planned to support the organization by counterfeiting, that he had told a federal agent that he had engaged in the manufacture of napalm and silencers, and that he had planned attacks on various targets in Minnesota. In a plea agreement, Johnson was convicted of one count of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and the government dropped other charges. At sentencing, the district court determined that his three prior convictions for robbery, attempted robbery, and possession of a short-barreled shotgun were violent felonies for purposes of the Armed Career Criminal Act. The conviction for possession of a short-barreled shotgun counted because the court applied the residual clause of the act. A determination that a person's prior convictions are violent felonies for purposes of the act increases the penalty for conviction of certain kinds of gun offenses, including possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. The penalty increases from a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence to a 15-year minimum sentence in federal prison. The statutory provision in question, Title 18 United States Code Section 924E2B, has two clauses. The first, the so-called element clause, applies to any crime punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year that has as an element the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another. This is fairly straightforward for courts to apply. They simply look at the elements of the crime. The second clause, however, has caused significant trouble for the lower courts. It applies to felonies that are burglary, arson, or extortion, involve the use of explosives, or otherwise involve conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. That last phrase, conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, has been before the Supreme Court 5 times in 7 years and is a subject of multiple splits of authority in the Circuit Courts of Appeal, 14, according to Johnson's counsel. Justice Antonin Scalia has argued in a series of dissents that the residual clause is unconstitutionally vague because it does not provide sufficient guidance to the lower courts or to potential defendants regarding which crimes will be used to enhance punishment. Johnson's case has been argued before the justices twice. After an initial argument on November 5, 2014, on the issue of whether possession of a short-barreled shotgun is a crime of violence for purposes of the residual clause, the justices ordered additional briefing to determine whether the residual clause in the Armed Career Criminal Act of 1984, 18 U.S.C. Section 924E2B2, is unconstitutionally vague. On April 20th, the court heard re-argument on the vagueness issue. Johnson's lawyer, Catherine Menendez, argued that the residual clause of the violent felony definition of the Armed Career Criminal Act is unconstitutionally vague because its text and structure do not set out with clarity what predicate offenses fall within its coverage and what do not. Its vagueness is proved by this court's inability, after repeated efforts, to discern a meaningful and replicable interpretive framework that will guide lower courts. Justice Samuel Alito seems skeptical of the need to reach out and decide the constitutional issue, where the justices could simply decide that mere possession of a short-barreled shotgun is not within the definition of violent crime contained in the residual clause. He also pressed hard on the vagueness issue itself. He asked whether the statute is unconstitutionally vague or whether it has been rendered so by the Supreme Court's precedents. Can a statute be vague because this court messes it up? He asked defense counsel. Justice Elena Kagan pressed on whether there might be an accepted, uncontroversial core of cases to which the residual clause applied, whether or not that included possession of a short-barrel shotgun. She was anticipating the government's argument that challenges on vagueness grounds in this case should be as applied rather than facial. The government says that to declare a statute facially vague, all its applications have to be facially vague, she noted. Johnson's lawyer, predictably, rejected that standard. During Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dreeben's argument, the court pressed him hard on the standard the court should be applying to decide when a particular crime fit within the residual clause. Should the lower courts look at the charge in the abstract, they asked, or should judges be applying a standard that considered how a crime was committed in the mine run of cases? Dreeben appeared to argue that the court should be considering how often a particular crime presented the risk in the real world. It is not a precise statistical analysis, he said. Congress could not have envisioned that this court and the lower courts have available to them statistics that for most crimes do not exist in order to gauge risk levels. It instead intended a judgment exercise based on experience. Justice Scalia pushed back hard against that standard. I don't know what you mean by judgment exercise based on experience. What experience do I have regarding these innumerable state crimes? I've not heard any case involving any of these state crimes. What experience are you asking me to apply? Dreeben argued that the judgment was mixed, based in part on the elements of the crime and partly on the way it was likely to be committed. The Department of Justice has internal guidance on what cases should be considered, Dreeben said, although that guidance is not available to the public. The justices were also grappling in part with some of the more shrouded portions of federal criminal practice. When and how the Department of Justice decides to charge, what guidelines are followed by prosecutors in reaching those decisions, and when and how pre-sentence reports were prepared. In most cases, given the prevalence of guilty pleas, it is these non-public actions that determine the likely sentence the defendant will face. Justice Scalia and Mr. Dreeben also engaged in a discussion of the rule of lenity as it applies in residual clause cases, with the government arguing that closed cases should mean that the defendant loses. Both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia were skeptical of how often lenity actually would be applied at sentencing. One interesting legal issue that will extend beyond this case will be what standard the court should apply to vagueness challenges in criminal cases. Should it be one where the challenges must proceed as applied, so long as there are some instances which would be clearly within the terms of the statute? Or is there a point at which there is sufficient uncertainty that the statutory provision is facially unconstitutional? How should statutes that inherently include judgment calls, such as serious risk, be construed? And in the words of Justice Anthony Kennedy, is there a different vagueness standard for sentencing than for a statement of what a crime is at the outset? Vague statutes present significant problems in two directions. They fail to tell citizens what behavior is outlawed or what penalties will apply to violations of the law, and they provide too much leeway to law enforcers, police, and judges to decide when to arrest and punish. In Johnson, there was no question that the conduct was illegal or that it was subject to at least a 10-year sentence. The issue is how much more punishment might apply. Based on oral argument, the court will consider whether to apply different vagueness tests in different circumstances. When the issue is defining the illegal conduct, an issue citizens will have to determine, the court might require better drafting so that ordinary people will know what they can or cannot do. When the issue is sentencing, it might give Congress more leeway, so long as lawyers and judges have sufficient clarity to fairly and consistently apply the law. In any event, it will be interesting to see whether the court chooses Johnson to grapple with this set of complex issues. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.